Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, Wednesday, April 19th, 2023, we're going to be answering three questions we've been hearing from international educators over the last 7 days. And as we do each week on the Roundup, we take the questions we answer here on Wednesdays from our newsletter, called All the SMIE News Fit to Share, that comes out on Monday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern, if you subscribe through our website. I'll drop the links to the website, the email edition of the newsletter, and also the LinkedIn version of the newsletter that you can subscribe to either way, whichever way you prefer to get your international edification news each week. And just to say thank you to everyone who has subscribed in the last few weeks. We're now well over 1,000 subscribers combined between the LinkedIn version and the email versions from our website. So thanks very much for making all the SMIE News Fit to Share part of your international edification each week. So those news stories that we cover, generally there's two or three themes that we see developing around common news items that we see, and we put together these questions to then answer via these news stories and as to how international education and the way we do it in our offices in the United States and around the world, how that can be impacted by what these news stories might be pointing us in the direction that might be something new or different than we need to be aware of as we conduct our business. And oftentimes there are global events that impact what we do in international education, that impact policies and practices that in terms of how we conduct our business in recruiting students, in taking care of students on campus, and sending students abroad. And we cover that quite in depth here through the newsletter as well as the Roundup here on Wednesdays. So thanks again for being a part of the conversation. Also, a shout out to those that are listening to the audio-only version of the podcast, a podcast version of the Midweek Roundup. Now let's get right into our first story of the day. And this one is, or the first question of the day, and that is, what is the value of current student social contact? And this may sound fairly intuitive and obvious for international educators that we know our survey data shows consistently over the years that future students, prospective students, want to hear from current students as part of their overall evaluation of different options for where they can study. So we see the value of that every day. So it's a kind of a rhetorical question. It has great value, of course. But I want to share an example of what we've been fortunate enough at UNLV to be a part of in the last year. We have, for those of you who aren't aware of the College Tour, it's a show that profiles different universities each season. They do usually 8 to 10 universities each season, where they send teams out to the different colleges that they're going to profile, do in-depth interviews with them, see them in action in the classroom, in the labs, wherever it might be on campus, involved in activities off campus, whatever it is. So the College Tour produces a series of these, and our version for UNLV just released in the past week, and it's available on Amazon as well. It's downloadable on YouTube or watchable on YouTube as well. So it's something that we've seen great value in, and one of the reasons we got involved in the project is to really give our promotional efforts a boost for having great content that's all about our students, that profiles different parts of our campus community and different aspects of who our students are, where they're from, what they're engaged in. It's typically an hour show that premieres on the College Tour. And then they cut each of the different student segments into a number of minutes. And we have I think from the versions that I've seen, we've got 20 different video shorts that cover these different experiences, that talk about the graduate school experience, student-athlete experience, global experiences at UNLV, which I'm very excited about, military and veteran services, rebel health and wellness, be a part of the rebellion, UNLV in the community, Rebels Forever, talking about the alumni piece, diverse campus community, high-impact research, rebel innovation and entrepreneurship, talking about student support and success, rebel life at UNLV, Hispanic serving research universities, innovative academics at UNLV, preparing students for careers, the power of diversity, adventure beyond the neon lights, access to education at UNLV, and the rebel advantage. All of these are kind of the themes that were of the different individual student shorts that they did. So the 20 different videos that can make up the primary episode. So about 2-3 minutes each student has to tell their story through the imagery and the video compilations that were put together. And now we have not only this massive episode that we can share out as a whole, but we can use each of these individual video shorts, 2-3 minutes each, with each set of students or each student telling their story around that particular topic. So really exciting to see what this all looks like now. There's a landing page, which I'll be sharing the link to. It was in the newsletter this Monday as well. But it's the kind of content that I would hope every international admissions office would dive to have, because this is the kind of content that paints that broad picture of your institution that only your current students can tell. And yes, not all of these, there's I think three international students that are in the mix here altogether in these videos, but it tells a story about life in all parts of the campus community, in the community outside the university, as well as life after university studies. So I think that's so valuable. A couple of the students that were profiled came for bachelor's degree and also did master's and doctoral degrees at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So there's so much content in there that is just going to have such amazing value for us as we push this out to our partners, global partners around the world, educational agents who are recruiting for us, to guidance counselors in international schools, so that they can have a real sense of who UNLV is and that they can share this with their students, and their students can find this organically and through intense social media pushes that we'll be doing as well to maximize the value of this. And in addition to those 20 video shorts that are all part of that same master episode, there's also Ask Admissions, Navigating Financial Aid. Obviously, there's domestic implications for all of these videos. And then Coffee with the President, where the host of the College Tour series sits down with our VP for Admissions and Financial Aid, with our president of the university, and go in-depth into the university perspective behind the scenes, not just the student perspective. So it's really what they call the inside scoop. So I think there's some amazing content in this that will have legs far beyond the initial premiere this week of this content. So I'm very excited to have this now to share with our partners around the world that can in turn share it with their students and really extend the life of this and get into the hands of the students that want to come the real stories of how our current students have been living their lives and experiencing the campus and taking advantage of everything that the university has to offer. So I would encourage each of you to put this together as an institution. Took a vast amount of time and effort over the course of several months in terms of going through an application process for the students that were going to be a part of these interviews, to create the opportunities for these short video clips that are part of go up into each student's little mini story, having that all planned out. So huge logistical operation to get this underway. And is this achievable for every college and university? No, because a college tour can't do every college and university in the country. It's maybe if they're around 50 more years, they get to about 8 or 9 of these every year. So we'll see. But this is the kind of content that ideally you want to have that you can then maximize its use through your prospective student audiences. And each one of these videos speaks to a different point other than perhaps the outliers that are very, very much for specific groups like military and Hispanic research institutions, those types of things that are very, not niche, but certainly are not going to apply to every student applicant to the university, but they will have particular uses throughout the communication flow, showing about what all the different elements of our campus community. But each of these video clips there can be, for each student clip, there can be pieces of that that we cut up and we have available for different Confluent messaging that we have going out throughout the year that we have as part of our regular social messaging, social content that we put out throughout the recruitment cycle. So all of this is just such amazing content to create. I remember when one of the first things we did when I started at Education USA back in 2008, when we launched the late 2008, we launched the first social channels for Education USA in early 2009 on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitter, and then built our presence up from there and our content. One of the first things I said we needed to do is we needed to get some student interviews done where we would go to campuses. So we went to three area local campuses, to American University, to Georgetown, to George Mason, and four colleges, also Northern Virginia Community College. And we did sets of student interviews on each campus with about four to six students on each site. And we compiled those into video shorts, into a master version that we cut up for promotional purposes for the Education USA website. We created playlists on our YouTube channel for these particular videos that highlighted different elements about the college search, about why they chose particular institutions, talking about their current student experiences, all of the pieces of the puzzle that you want to have as the kind of straight from the horse's mouth documented stories of why students choose to study where they do. And that's what everybody wants to have and everybody should have if you're going to have a real comprehensive and on-point messaging for your prospective students that can answer the kinds of questions. And there's content in here that prospective students would love, that parents will love, that future donors to the university will love, that we have this content now that we can repurpose and reuse for many months, hopefully years to come, where this kind of thing can be replicated, where we can do Where Are They Now pieces on some of these students in 4 or 5 years to see how they're doing as successful alumni at the university. There's a couple that are already in there that are portrayed as alumni or recent grads. So this is everything in terms of how I know our admissions folks, particularly the undergrad side, but also on the grad side, are really excited about the possibilities for what this content is going to allow us to do and allow us to provide prospective student audiences a much broader view of the campus community that can hopefully speak to everybody who might be interested in UNLV to find that touch point in one of these videos that speaks to them and is like, oh, yes, that's me. I want to have that life. I want to do what this student has done. That's the kind of thing every college or university admission office should hope that they have someday to work with future students, future students' parents, to convince them about whether or not our institution is going to be right for them. Because as much as we say we know what we're doing and we're experts in our field, part of being an expert is knowing what works. And knowing what works with your prospective student audiences is knowing that you're not the best way to get your message across. Yes, you can show you know everything about your institution, but what's going to convince an 18-year-old about whether your university is the right one for them? Whether it's going to be the right, what we always talk about, the fit, the feel of our institutions. It's not right for everybody, but are you the right person to tell them that? Or is a current student who's living their life that might be from their background, in their major that they want to do, are they the best examples of who should be telling the story? And the obvious answer is yes, those people are. The current students are. Our recent grads are. They're the ones who have been there, done that, got the t-shirt, and have lived that experience and can share with future students what that looks like. So really excited about this College Tour content that we're going to be able to use to reach out to our overseas students and share with them through our agents, through our communication flows with those students about why UNLV is such an amazing place to study and to build a foundation on which a successful career and life can be built. That's what we're really excited about. And so the value of what that content really means is it is everything. And it should be for everybody who's involved with international ed. So we'll talk more about this in the weeks and months to come, I'm sure, as other kinds of content comes out that I see profiled. I highlight those kind of best cases out there, kind of best in show kind of products that can help attract prospective students to your institution. We'll share that out for you. And I know not everybody's going to be able to do the college tour, but it's a great model to follow and to pick out elements from what they do at each campus and say, okay, this is something, not just a virtual or a college tour video that you can have, everybody does those, but to have the kind of student profiles and what those profiles say about the different aspects of your student experience on campus. That's ideally what you want to have, and have a sampling of those that you can have these short 2 to 3 minute videos of each student, and from within each of those you can break those down and to share compilations on different aspects of campus life from a number of different student perspectives. So such amazing content that we're now going to have available to you, and I hope everyone else can get to that point where they can at least have some of that available for use in their student recruitment efforts. Now, onto a very different question that we talk about each week. Not each week, but it comes up quite often because whether we like it or not, China is one of the top two sources of international students in the United States, had been number one for many years, and by this fall will have slipped back to number two. But it is by far and away the number between it and third place is a huge chasm, and that will never be breached by any other country. India and China are going to continue to be the two biggest drivers. India will overtake China this fall, but China will still remain a significant player in international education circles in the United States, in terms of our campuses, in terms of our faculty, in terms of our hopefully study abroad again as those programs begin to kick back in this fall and this summer and fall. Some have already gone in the spring. Had been very expensive, but some are starting to go back. So the question is, will there be a positive change in U.S.-China relations? And to answer this question, it's always good to take kind of a scanning of the field and find out where some of the pain points really are. And there's no surprises here that faculty research, particularly highlighted by the Trump initiative or the China initiative during the Trump administration, that targeted Chinese faculty coming to the U.S. Nefarious intent, according to the government at that point, with the China initiative, suspecting faculty of coming to on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party and with the intent to steal technology, intellectual property, all of that. And that was the main reason for the China initiative, to clamp down on that. You had the FBI director Christopher Wray saying that that's one of the most significant areas of concern that the Bureau has, Federal Bureau of Investigation had in the United States in terms of internal challenges to government authority, was the influence of potential theft of intellectual property and technology back to China. We've seen that's been an issue. We've seen visas be an issue. We've seen the impact, as we talked about in the newsletter this week, about gun violence. All of those things have particularly been impacting Asian Americans, and racism came out as a result of the pandemic, blaming China, blaming anyone who's Asian as responsible for the pandemic. So these are the things that we've seen. We've seen visa issuance to students during the Trump years. We saw that those that were connected to institutions in China that were part of what they call in China the civil-military fusion strategy, where there's military connections with universities in China that have what the U.S. government at the time considered pipelines for talent coming to the U.S. with the intent of becoming agents for China in the United States, potentially stealing technology, all of that. So there's been a lot of different negatives that have happened over the past few years, and that no place is the friction felt more acutely than in the academy, the U.S. academy, and in research institutions, that what has really happened has been a breakdown in university exchanges that threatens, according to an FP article talking about the breakdown in university exchanges threatens understanding and collaborative research. I was at AIEA in February in DC, and there was a talk specifically on this topic about Chinese research activity versus U.S. research activity, where those two have, where there's been collaborative efforts in the past and how they've dipped substantially as a result of the previous administration into bleeding over into the Biden administration. So there's been real challenges there. So whether there's a future here, some people see this as a kind of a decoupling period for the U.S. and China in terms of relationships between the research institutions in both countries. You've seen China, obviously, over the last decade or two have been significantly ramping up their own research activities in terms of their Thousand Talents Project, where they've been hiring Western faculty to be a part of helping build capacity, building reputations of different institutions in China. All of these have gotten on the radar of certainly U.S. and other Western leaders in terms of challenges to autonomy in the academy, to collaborative relationships between countries, universities, professors in different countries. And there's a lot of kind of unease, really, in the academy nowadays related to collaborative efforts with China. But I always go back to how international education in the past has always tended to be that which rises above in terms of being in Congress. It used to be considered a white hat issue, that everyone was on board with what the value of international education was to the United States in terms of bringing students and scholars from abroad, experiencing our culture, our campuses, our universities, and returning home with that kind of hopefully positive experiences in the United States, and sharing that with spreading the good word about the United States back home. That public diplomacy piece that the U.S. State Department always sees as its prime directive when it comes to international education and everything that they do, where in we've also seen we've seen other divisions of the U.S. government's commerce to sharing how economically powerful international education is as an export industry for the United States. So we've always seen these kind of positive elements attributed to international education. But even during the heights of the Cold War, U.S.-Soviet relations academically were fairly strong. And they survived a lot of external pressures with, no matter what was going on between their governments, the academia tended to be fairly engaged throughout that time. And that's broken down to some extent, to a large extent in the last 5 years, five, six, 7 years. So we see now, I think there's some hesitancy. We've seen in Cornell University, there was a proposed joint program with Peking University, one of the most prestigious institutions in China, that dual degree or a combined program there, there were concerns over the Cornell faculty overwhelmingly voted to oppose that partnership, citing concerns of academic freedom and transparency. Students on campus were decrying Beijing's human rights violations and mass detentions of Uyghurs, and that from the student standpoint, from the faculty standpoint, and this is from an article I was quoting earlier from FP, it became very clear from the student standpoint, from the faculty standpoint, there was no interest in expanding the relationship in this way without more rigorous ethical oversight. And they did it anyway. And this is the university went ahead with the program earlier. So that was a real, and it's not, I won't say it's a symptom, but there's a certain segment of U.S. higher education that tends to be very susceptible to the whims and the wills and the elitism of academia in the United States at particular institutions, the more elite institutions where they see themselves as the beacon of freedom and humanity and everything that's good in the world, in terms of everything that their institution does and should do. Divesting from fossil fuels companies and all of these things are part of their kind of their ethos at this point. Covers a wide range of issues, but the China piece on human rights issues seem to be a real challenge. Now, this example of this program in Cornell, these kinds of programs have existed for decades with Chinese universities, U.S. and Chinese universities. State universities that I've been a part of have been part of 1+2+1 programs for at least two decades that partner U.S. institutions with Chinese partners to allow undergraduate students to do, at the end of 4 years, have two degrees, one from their Chinese original host university and one from their American partner university, as a way to bridge the gap between our countries. And I am always more in favor of engagement rather than disengagement when it comes to these kinds of issues. We've had a very different situation in Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year. That war is certainly symbolic of Russian attempt to expand its influence, to reestablish its union, expand its influence throughout Europe and trying to give itself a buffer between itself and the EU. That has massively backfired on Putin. And a lot of universities have pulled out of relationships a lot of Russian student universities were basically following, forced to, or decided they're going to follow what the government says, or not going to muddy the waters, or kind of throw up any protest to it because they can't. Because if they do, they're going to be arrested. So for academia in Russia, that's been a no-go because it's under the thumb completely of Putin, and any dissent is not allowed. What I think we've lost in that is that partnerships that did exist, which were very much cut because of political influence, because of Russia's invasion of another country, and that the universities backing that invasion, even though there was no justification for it, that the world would accept, that you see in the United States. This is maybe a symptom of the more divisive country we live in, the more divisive world we live in, where differences are no longer appreciated and conversations about differences are even less valued in some environments. And you kind of see a bit of that happening in higher ed in the United States as well, as a microcosm of that. But I think this example here in Cornell certainly is of voting of students and faculty saying, no, we're not going to engage because they're bad. That there's no value in us engaging, no value in having their students coming to us and getting our degree, even though they certainly could be very well qualified to do so. There's no value in having them come to our campus to experience the United States, our culture, our values, and be real advocates for the United States in the end, as State Department has long talked about, to be our greatest champions when they go back home. As there are many students that I interacted with when I was part of these dual degree programs that would come from China, have such an amazing experience. A lot of them, after they finished their degrees, would come back and do graduate programs. Others stayed and got married and now have families and are so glad that they made the decision to come. And how is that not a better outcome than not engaging at all? And I think there's a real undercurrent here about, and I'm sad to see it happening in academia in the U.S. at certain levels. I don't think we're at that level necessarily at UNLV where we're disengaging in that regard. I think there's certain value in keeping those doors avenues of conversation open, and there's more good in engaging rather than disengaging on these kind of important issues. So we have to be careful and protect ourselves in the process, but in the end, we definitely need to be looking out for the broader good. And this Cornell piece about the disconnect that's happening and being felt in the academy, certainly an article, a piece of this. There's Stuart Anderson in Forbes has talked about, if you remember, the China initiative, and the fall over on the student visa side is students who are connected to the civil-military fusion were still being denied visas. He writes about that still happening today. The numbers aren't huge, but they do have public opinion value for China, trying to show that the U.S. is its enemy because they're not accepting our students that are connected from certain universities. You've seen Karen Fisher do a very good article this past week in her in the Chronicle, and she also covered it in her newsletter, Latitudes, about asking the question, can U.S. research recover from the China initiative? There's a lot of concerns about that, about the oversight the government should have, about whether the China initiative, even though it's no longer policy under the Biden administration, whether that's still lingering impacts of that are impacting research. There's certainly talk about that in February at AIEA. So we'll see where that goes. The last question of the day that I'll focus on very briefly is Australia's current migration system supporting international students? We've all heard the news that international students have been returning to Australia in droves this past January, February, March, as their new academic year began. What we've heard is that the numbers are up. They're not quite up to pre-pandemic levels yet in terms of overall numbers, but the volume has been increasing and in positive directions. There is expectations that that growth will continue to get them back over pre-pandemic levels. But you see some stories popping up that tend to throw some shade onto what's being seen as a boom period for Australia and international education circles. You see stories from the PIE this past week about unequal employability opportunities for South Asian graduates. They talk about their South Asians in a qualitative study. I think there were only 20 students in the study, but it was specific to their experience at the end of their academic circles, talking about their experiences with career fairs and applying for jobs. They talk about the frustrations in finding job openings, and when they go to career fairs, that so few of the jobs are available to them because companies won't hire internationals. That you see another story about the Australian migration system not fit for purpose, according to Universities Australia, because there aren't supports and encouragements in policy that encourages international students to stay and work in the country. But the reality is so many of them do want to come. And we've talked about in the past the two-step migrants that many of these South Asian students are planning to be. So there's only, and there's data, the data certainly supports that it's not as easy a path because only 16% of international students going on do go on to become permanent residents. And Australia does have a need for immigrants because they need more of these folks to remain in country after they graduate, to use their skills they've developed through the vocational and university systems there to help the country economically can sustain itself. You also see the housing shortages have been popping up stories all over the globe, but particularly acute in Australia. There's one story, international students resorting to pitching tents in living rooms as rental shortage bites. And there's a picture of someone who's pitched a tent in a living room. Looks like the kitchen's right there. They've got some laundry, but they've got a tent. It's probably a 8x8 tent. If that, two suitcases on the outside with a deck chair, and that's what they are paying $300 a week, Australian dollars a week, to pitch a tent in someone else's living room. Unbelievable. I mean, it gives you a chuckle after a while, but I can't believe that this is actually happening. So there's a lot out there in the news that does suggest that there's some challenges in Australia, and as there are all countries, with managing their international students and providing the best quality services and programming and pathways to citizenship beyond their study and permanent residency. But that's what we have for you today on the Roundup. We appreciate you being a part of the conversation, and we look forward to chatting with you again soon. Have a great day. Cheers.